Welcome to the NAMI Radio Hour, brought to you by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, Tennessee, a broadcast that explores the world of mental illness and its impact on the family, society, and the individual. We come your way live from the studios of Radio Free Nashville each Wednesday from 10 to 11 a.m. Central Time. It is our hope that you will be encouraged, enlightened, and maybe even entertained from the stories of our guests. The NAMI Radio Hour is a production of NAMI, Tennessee. To contact the show, send an email to info@namitn.org. And now, here's your host, NAMI Tennessee Executive Director, Jeff Fladen.
Good morning.
I hear the train a-come. It's rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I
shot. Yes, you are listening to the NAMI Radio Hour with a little Johnny Cash, Folsom Prison Blues, and I chose to begin today's show on the NAMI Radio Hour with Johnny Cash because he brought attention to people in prison. And it wasn't just awful people that we need to lock up and throw away the key, but there were human beings in there. And Johnny Cash was quite the social activist. But even before Johnny Cash was Dorothea Dix. And the point here today, and the focus of today's show, is about what's going on with our jails and prisons as it relates to persons with mental illness and addiction, or both. And we have a lot of talk going on and activity around the country to do something about this issue. There's a concern there's too many people in our jails and prisons. But before we get into that, I wanted to really focus on how we got to this point. And before Johnny Cash was Dorothea Dix. And Dorothea Dix was a crusader in the 1800s who really brought major attention onto the issue that our asylums had become snake pits, basically. They were horrible places where people were treated really badly. We didn't even have good treatments yet, at least in terms of medications. The invention of Thorazine changed institutions a lot and led in part to our movement of community supports and treating with people with mental illness in the community rather than sending them away, often for the rest of their lives. But Dorothy campaigned against the mistreatment, and she tried to focus on the dignity of persons with mental illness. And her work really, although it took a lifetime, several generations from her campaigning, including here in Tennessee, to closing of many of the nation's state hospitals. Now, there was great excitement in the 1960s when the wave of deinstitutionalization began, and I believe that's still the longest word that I know, unless anti-disestablishmentarianism is really a word. But deinstitutionalization for sure is a word, and we've had a movement to close hospitals. And many people have expressed great concerns about this. First, we don't appear to be willing to devote the resources to have long-term inpatient hospitalization treatment for all who need it. So it seems pretty clear we're not going to build enough hospital beds just to institutionalize people that have serious mental illness, let alone the human rights issue of allowing people to have freedom, dignity, self-determination. And most people with serious mental illness are not dangerous. They may have danger to themselves from others through crime and being vulnerable and being in bad neighborhoods and in poverty. But persons with mental illness are more often victims of violence than they are perpetrators. But meanwhile, we have had people whose behavior, often connected with mental illness or addiction, bothers our communities. And it becomes a police matter. And police arrest people and police put people in jail. And now we hear that our jails are the largest mental health institutions. Think of the human cost. Think of the cost to families. Think of the cost to our country when rather than working and supporting oneself, we have people that are locked up. So now we have a lot of talk of corrections reform going on, and we're going to share some news programs and various recordings, and I will also talk to you about what's going on in Tennessee in this area. We do have some dollars and some efforts to divert people with mental illness and addiction from jail and into treatment where they can find recovery and hopefully a better life and save our government dollars as well. So first up, I want to share a short video about why we're using prisons to treat mental illness.
Disturbing video that raises questions about the treatment of the mentally ill behind bars.
He would hear voices.
The extraction team restrained him. Minutes later, the 33-year-old was dead.
Jails are the number one mental health facilities across the country. They house more mentally ill person versus any hospital, any psych facilities, any anything. They're patients, not prisoners.
Mental illness is the only disease that when you're in a crisis, the cops are called. If you're having a heart attack, you don't call the police.
People with mental illness are being criminalized instead of being provided treatment.
These kind of jails and law enforcement, that's public safety net. That's where you end up.
There has to be some sort of solution, some sort of help for people who are suffering from mental illness and become involved with the police.
Jeff was the youngest of our four. He was finally diagnosed a paranoid schizophrenic. When he was totally out of control and very frightening, I would have to call the police on him. They didn't know what to do.
I would get calls all the time when I was on patrol for a person who was in a mental health crisis. I had no clue how to handle it. And I would just keep getting the repeat calls every couple days or every week to the same house, the same person. And I just accepted it that, this person's just going to be a repeat caller.
We decided very early on that we needed to address folks that were nonviolent misdemeanor offenders that were truly being put in jail because of their illness. We knew that it was law enforcement that were first responders and that they would be the ones that would be in contact with individuals in crisis.
So we decided what we would do first is train law enforcement officers in 40-hour crisis intervention training. So they're trained to recognize mental illness. When they come up on somebody that's got the kind of strange behavior, they're not using their command voice and the command presence like they're taught in the academy. They realize right away that this person has a problem. We brought together a bunch of law enforcement officers from the sheriff and the San Antonio Police Department, and every one of them didn't want to be there. I heard things like, I'm a cop, I'm not a social worker, I don't believe in these hug-a-thug programs, and this is a bunch of BS.
Before I went through the 40-hour CIT training myself, I didn't have the resources on how to handle mental illness. Well, now, it's way different. You know, I have confidence that when I go into someone's home, if they are experiencing some type of, you know, mental health crisis, that I can get them to the right facility, and then I may never hear from them again.
I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm a friend, I'm a voter, I'm a volunteer, I'm all these people. I contribute to my community and I have a mental illness. My diagnosis is major depression with psychotic features, dissociative identity disorder, and panic disorders. I've done the presentations to CIT training. I tell them, I want to be treated the way you want your mother to be treated if she was ever diagnosed with a mental illness. If I'm in a crisis, you know, I'm having a crisis, and I don't understand what's going on around me.
In incidents with people who have mental health issues, it's unfortunate to see the ones that result in the use of deadly force, where an officer didn't have CIT training, and possibly armed with that kind of information, that kind of training, outcomes may have been different.
I never knew each morning when I got up what I might find. He began to talk about a fire in the garage. So I thought, would he, without knowing what he's doing, start a fire? How much danger is he in, and how much danger am I in? So I called the police and I said, I'm terribly frightened. When they arrived, I introduced them to Jeff, and in this case, they came in plain clothing. They weren't in police uniforms. Now, they could have handcuffed him, I guess, and pulled him out, but they are taught how different that person is that they're dealing with. So they began to talk to Jeff. If they can get the person that's ill to, in their own mind, they're cooperating, it's far less violent. It's better for the patient, and certainly it's better for our police.
When nonviolent people go to jail with mental illness, they stay 3 or 4 times longer than a violent offender. But when they get released, if they're not hooked up into treatment, they're going to be right back in. There are so many people in their emergency rooms who shouldn't be there. Previous police chief here has actually kept data on how long his officers are spending in emergency rooms waiting for psych evals and medical clearance, 8 to 14 hours. He spent $600,000 a year in overtime. Now here at the Restoration Center, the law enforcement officers are in and out within 15 minutes.
What we have here at the Restoration Center is services for patients who are in crisis. It's either walk-in or brought in here by a CIT. They recognize the patient's in crisis. They're not truly suicidal. They don't really want to hurt somebody. They just need help.
There are about 18,000 people a year who are brought mainly by law enforcement officers to this restoration center who used to go to jail or emergency rooms or put back on the street. If you're a taxpayer and really don't know a lot about mental illness, the fact that the public's a lot safer when these people get treated, and the taxpayer saves a ton of money. Over the last 5 years, we've saved about $50 million in taxpayers' dollars.
But we want everyone trained because of the potential daily that someone's going to come across someone who's in crisis. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of how soon.
We've been coming up on 6 years of existence, and we don't have a use of force on our unit, which means we've never tased anybody, we've never shot anybody, we've never hit anybody with an ASP, but patients, talking to them, we get the result we want in the end, and we don't have to force it on them.
You want CIT to respond because you're going to get the help that you need rather than be sent to jail.
The issues that police officers have with people who have mental illness is not unique to San Antonio. That's all over the country, all over the world. So any city that would decide to focus on this, put an emphasis on this, would certainly benefit from it.
I no longer thought, what if they have to shoot Jeff?
We save money, we improve public safety, and people can get functional again. I mean, why wouldn't you do this? It's really a no-brainer.
This movie is really a good illustration of the issues that are going on here, and I want to expand on 2 points before I play some other video recordings or sound recordings. This talked about the Restoration Center in San Antonio, which is often looked at as a model of the way to do things right. They claim a very large savings and a huge reduction in use of force by the police. So those are pretty neat things. They said $50 million was saved during a specific time period. Now, there were two parts that are really clear in there, besides the idea that, mental illness is just putting people in prison, and we've criminalized a disease, which is just really wildly inappropriate. But that's what's happened with our system. When the long-term hospitals closed and we did not have enough community alternatives to try to maintain people safely, and if there were issues by those whose behavior causes concern, such as agitation, such as destruction of property, such as assault or public drunkenness and things of that nature. You heard about the development of a center where people were taken by police and dropped off. And instead of waiting hours and hours in an emergency room for an assessment, they were taken to the center for assessment and for treatment. This is the heart of what I describe as pre-arrest diversion. Rather than arresting the person and putting them into the criminal justice system, they were taken to a place where there can be assessment and treatment, and we hope to see a growth of this in Tennessee. The other piece was the training for police officers for CIT. And CIT training helps police officers to nonviolently address the situation. There was one case here where it talked about that, well, the police came in plain clothes and they didn't handcuff my son. They talked to him and they got him to cooperate. And that's just a better outcome for the police and for the individual. Without CIT, what we sometimes have is families that are afraid to call the police because they don't know what'll happen. So we have a lot of CIT in Tennessee. In fact, it's often called the Memphis model, or a the majority, I think, of CIT training in the United States utilizes the Memphis model that was developed in Tennessee. Major Sam Cochran and not sure Mr. DuPont, his title, but they worked with the University of Memphis and the development of the CIT Center. And we now have a lot of training in Tennessee for CIT. Some of the cities include Memphis, Jacksonville, Chattanooga, Knoxville, Murfreesboro, Oak Ridge, and there's many more. That's not an exclusive list, but there's many communities that are providing CIT training, and also they have spaces in their training for officers in other communities that do not have training. So it's out there quite a bit, and it's something that NAMI Tennessee really wants to promote, the CIT training. So we heard about CIT. We heard about a crisis place, a place to take people instead of to jail. Now, we still think people need to go to jail if their crime is such that they need that. Being under the influence of alcohol or drugs or having mental illness does not just excuse behavior. And our criminal justice system seems to be designed in holding people accountable. So for violent crime, when people go to jail, we hope that there's assessment and treatment in the jail as well, because those are still contributors, and we still feel that recovery is something that we all should support. So this takes us now to the legislature. And right now, today in Tennessee, the legislature, besides looking at a lot of proposed laws, needs to pass the budget. And our governor, Governor Haslam, submitted a budget that included $15 million for pre-arrest diversion in the budget. There's also some bills, at least one bill I know of, for a center in Knoxville that focuses on a partnership with providers and government in Knoxville, along with now it would be with some state dollars and get people treated. So we have that bill, but we have money in the legislature I want to share now a report about what's going on in a different state and how we're looking at this issue.
It's a statistic that oftentimes gets pushed under the rug, but according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 children have a mental health diagnosis. This year, the Texas Senate Committee on Health and Human Services has made mental health a priority during the legislative session. As Aaron Nichols explains, it's an issue that has a greater impact on our community than we might think.
It's a startling fact, but in Bexar County, 9% of our youth have attempted suicide.
Our kids get vision tests, they get physical education tests. I mean, there's a test to even see if their spine is crooked or not. They get hearing tests, but what they don't get is a mental health screening test.
That statistic is from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Lisa Jensen is the executive director of NAMI in San Antonio.
Texas is still way behind the national average when it comes to funding mental health care. And to me, that's really a crime.
And the issue doesn't just affect children. More than 12% of adults per 1,000 people in Bexar County have a serious mental diagnosis.
Unless we are able to get the correct funding that we need in San Antonio, we're going to continue to be behind the eight ball and not be able to help our residents because we don't have adequate funding.
That's why in February, NAMI chapters across Texas will talk to lawmakers in Austin about mental health.
This last legislative session, both sides came together and said this is a real issue.
State Senator Carlos Uresti is part of the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services. Uresti says this session, lawmakers will look at how to make sure people, especially children, have access to mental health care.
Perhaps providing better training or more training for our nurses, our counselors, our school nurses and our school counselors as well to be able to identify perhaps some of those students that are suffering, again, don't realize it.
NAMI will also push for a number of other initiatives, including more supportive housing and rental assistance, so individuals with mental illnesses can grow as productive citizens.
I think as society recognizes, we've got to have critical conversations like this. Otherwise, we won't be able to move forward.
NAMI is a nonprofit organization that offers a number of free classes on mental health for families, law enforcement, and educators. They are also always in need of funding. If you would like to learn more about their platform, you can go to our website, foxsanantonio.com, and click on news links. Live in the newsroom, Aaron Nichols, Fox News at 9.
So this story from Texas shows that their state is ahead of us, I would say, because they're also now focusing on children and the arrest of children and getting them help earlier. And I think that's going to be chapter two. We're not there yet. We're just really getting the discussion started in Tennessee about diverting people from jail and prison and trying to preserve somebody's ability to get employed in the future, to get into treatment, to be a productive member of society. Most people with mental illness are productive members of society. There are some whose condition is such that it interferes with work and relationships, with behaviors. That's how we diagnose mental illness. We don't have blood tests to say, oh, you have this mysterious thing. It's really inferred based on behaviors and how things like depression or anxiety or hallucinations or whatever symptoms may be interfere with one's daily functioning in life, such as holding a job, having relationships, or being in school. What I'd like to do now is move to what's it like for the individual. In NAMI, we often talk about learning from stories. So what's it like to have mental illness and be arrested? So we're now going to hear from an individual sharing their personal story.
Tonight, as part of our Broken Justice series, we have a NewsHour essay. Peyton Blau opens up about his bipolar disorder and frequent encounters with law enforcement.
I have two labels I'll carry for the rest of my life, bipolar and convicted felon. They're not mutually exclusive. I've been arrested 6 different times, all the while in a delusional, paranoid state of mind caused by my illness. What you know about society and how people typically behave doesn't apply to me. I enter a department store and it feels right to immediately take off my shoes. I'm convinced the government is plotting to control me, playing carefully selected songs on the radio to persuade me into making a certain decision. So I changed the station just to spite them. I throw three fingers up at a public security camera and tell President Obama to read between the lines. No, the rules of society don't apply to me, not when I'm having one of my episodes.
I just raise my hand like this.
My episodes, which are rare, can happen at any time and take many forms, from creating a piece of art to aggressively accusing UPS employees of being government workers smuggling weapons through their delivery routes. I'm able to show you these pictures because my wife has documented these episodes so that we can learn more about myself and ultimately help others learn.
Oh my gosh, this is a mess. You created a studio out here, baby. You look like a true artist.
You see, I'm not alone. More than half of all prison and jail inmates have a mental health issue. You can imagine the kind of reaction someone like me might have when delusions trigger an incident in which a police officer wants to engage with me, or worse, arrest me. Three of my six arrests went relatively well, with police getting me into custody safely. The other three were extremely violent because in my head, I was fighting for my life.
I was tased in the back of the police car in our hospital parking lot with leg irons and handcuffs on. And one of my charges that night were destruction of county property because I broke the leg irons.
Thankfully, around 6 years ago, my recovery kicked into high gear. I was asked to share my experiences with officers as part of something called crisis intervention training. In my experience, most officers want to help, but often simply lack the training to know what to do in these tough situations. One time I was arrested by an officer who I believe naturally possessed many of the things we train. He slowed down and didn't force the issue when I accused him of being an undercover agent. He waited for my brother to come from across town to bring my meds. When I accused him of giving me a poisoned bottle of water so I could take my pills, he immediately offered to take a sip to prove it was fine. There is no doubt we need more officers like this today. I came up with a training sheet which quickly describes for the police how to deal with someone like myself. Let the person think they're in control. Slow down and stay calm. One thing I always tell them is to imagine the person they're dealing with is their brother, mother, or good friend. The biggest shame of my life has been my criminal record, but now I get to take those experiences and help my community.
You are listening to the NAMI Radio Hour. We've reached the halfway point of today's show, which is about corrections reform and criminal justice, and the idea that we can divert people that have committed a crime, but it's related in some way to mental illness or substance abuse or both. And maybe treatment instead of jail would be a better idea. Well, it turns out, according to studies, that there's about an 8-to-1 savings, where each dollar invested in early treatment and diversion brings back $8 in savings. I mean, just imagine the idea of locking somebody up. They get out, they're locked up again. Police time, court time, jail time, versus somebody getting back to work. So we are looking at some expansion in Tennessee of pre-arrest diversion. We're also concerned about what goes on in the jail. And NAMI Tennessee has made a movie called Code, Correction Officer De-Escalation Education, which is some basic training for police officers for correction officers dealing with inmates with mental illness. So we don't believe everybody will be diverted. It really depends on the crime. But for minor crimes, police already have some discretion whether or not to make the arrest. But what they often don't have in Tennessee is a place to take the person rather than just let them go and have things continue or maybe get worse. So we need places where police can efficiently transport an individual so that they can get some assessment and get into treatment. That, we think, at NAMI and others, will really help. And there's a coalition that NAMI is part of, led by Judge Dan Eisenstein, and there's some other groups or coalitions in Tennessee working on this right now. So we believe that the time has come. And stories like what you just heard about an individual also lets you know that training and programs make a difference. He mentioned 6 arrests. 3 of them went pretty well. 3 did not go well. And when it doesn't go well, it doesn't help anybody. Now, I earlier shared information about a program from San Antonio, and there's actually a conference coming up on the 21st of February in Nashville, Mental Health and Incarceration Conference, and that's at Trevecca College, and folks from San Antonio will be there. So I urge anybody that's involved with a community that's interested in this issue to be there. Registration is free, but advanced registration is required. The best way to find it, I don't have the website. It's not actually a NAMI program, although we will be there, is to go to the Mental Health America of Middle Tennessee website. Just Google Mental Health America, Middle Tennessee, or sign up for the NAMI Tennessee Facebook page or NAMI Tennessee e-news, or send an email to me at info@namitn.org, and I'll get you the information. To sign up for our e-news, you just go to our webpage, namitn.org. At the bottom, it says sign up for e-news, and we'd like you to get to the training on mental health and incarceration that's coming up on February 21st. So that features folks from San Antonio. I'm going to now share a different program. This is about a diversion program in Massachusetts, and we're going to hear what they're doing. It says, prisons and jails have become our de facto mental health institutions. 7 to 10% of all police contacts involve mental illness. And an alternative to tying up already stretched law enforcement is creation of a program for jail diversion.
More and more people with mental illness are in the community, and they're being forced out onto the streets, on the sidewalks, on the playgrounds, in the parks. And, you know, certain behavior involves confrontations with the police. These aren't the felons. They're not people who have violently committed crimes or hurt other people. They're really committed nuisance-related offenses that typically end up being arrested for lack of better options to police officers.
Police really had only 2 options when they were confronted with an emotionally disturbed person in the community. They could either arrest them, which required hours and hours of paperwork and really resulted in nothing productive for the person, or they could bring the person to the hospital, in which case they often had to sit with the hospital personnel for many hours, which was very expensive to the police and very unsatisfactory to the person receiving services.
We were arresting people with mental illness for committing minor offenses, and we were running into the same people over and over again. So it was a reoccurring problem, a band-aid approach, with no proactive plan in place.
The number of arrests that were being made by the Framingham Police Department of mentally ill individuals in the community for minor crimes, nuisance offenses, that were really just symptoms of their mental illness, was something that the police department was uncomfortable with, and something that mental health operations in town was also uncomfortable with.
The jail diversion program was a really great idea of Deputy Chief Craig Davis of the Framingham Police Department. He was the commander of the SWAT team, which he was just constituting at the time. And he thought it would be a good idea for the negotiators on the SWAT team to have collaboration and training from a psychiatrist like me, because very often the people who were hostage takers or otherwise engaged with the SWAT team turned out to be psychiatrically or emotionally disturbed.
I wanted to replicate the model that we had established and succeeded at with for the SWAT team, to have a clinician at least be with the police officer on these calls and situations involving somebody with mental illness.
And he got the additional excellent idea that if they invited us to actually house our clinician in the police station, it would be much more likely that our clinician would become integrated into the police team. This is exactly what happened.
Any call in which there's a patient with a mental health issue, there's only so much training a police officer has. And to have these people on scene with us in the cruisers, driving around with us, is such an advantage for us. We can have these JDP clinicians who are riding around with us come on scene into these people's houses, into these people's environments, and see exactly what these people are dealing with and how they're living. And that way the clinician can make a decision based on what they see and what they hear from the person. Whereas when it comes to us having to make these decisions, like I said, we're not really trained for it. Whereas the JDP clinicians are able to come in, make a quicker decision, make the proper phone calls and the proper decisions that need to be made to get these patients the help they need quicker and to get us, the police officers, back on the street where we're more effective.
The police department traditionally, prior to JDP, arrived on the scene of a call where a person may be mentally ill and looked at the symptoms and fit them into a behavior pattern that would either allow an arrest for a criminal charge, or if there was nothing arrestable, they would be transported to the hospital. And in the past, what we ended up doing was we spent more time on treating people in the street than time policing the streets.
In the housing authority, we have many tenants down here that do have some issues, and from time to time we need the services of the jail diversion program. It gives the opportunity for the police to have an alternative of someone going to jail or someone getting some help at a hospital or at a facility. More times than not, the policeman would much rather have someone transported to the hospital or get involved in the program than taking them to jail.
Myself, as a police officer, I've been working within the school system for 9 years now, and the kids know who I am. They know I'm there to help them. And if I don't have to arrest them, I prefer not to and use the jail diversion program. The kinds of children I refer to the jail diversion program are children with emotional needs. And they're disruptive, and they keep on getting sent down to the student referral center. They'll eventually end up either in jail, locked up, and they could even be expelled from school. I feel the jail diversion program has helped all of the schools within Framingham, and it helps the kid immediately instead of waiting for an appointment 2 or 3 days later. The response is immediate, so it really works well for the school system. And it makes the parents and the children much happier.
The jail diversion program has 3 components. The first component is a training component. So we provide an ongoing training for the patrol division and the supervisors into the signs and symptoms of mental illness, what types of medications are appropriate, basic de-escalation techniques. The second component is a monthly operations meeting where we get together with all the key stakeholders from the program and talk about the program, talk about what the calls have been, talk about any problems that may have arisen, and also do some case planning around our most difficult or frequent callers. The third component, and in my opinion the most important component, is the ride-along program. That is where there is a clinician based in the car responding with patrol officers to calls for service. Being able to respond to the community at the time of the 911 call is, in my opinion, one of the most important aspects of the program and really lends to the program's success.
Initially, it was a little worrisome having a clinician ride with you in your cruiser. You weren't really sure, totally different backgrounds, total different perception of what's going on. After a while, you got to know them, you got to realize that they are there just to help, and they had no intention of getting involved in calls. It didn't concern them. A lot of times they'd be there on calls, and obviously not every call is a situation for the jail diversion program, but they became very good at standing back, knowing when to get involved, when to ask if they want to be involved, and they were right there anytime that they thought they could be of assistance. They were right there asking to go to the calls.
The Framingham Police Department provides the jail diversion clinicians with some office space, a telephone, and a police radio, and a Nextel phone. And the phone and the radio allow the clinicians to have immediate access to our personnel, and more importantly, they allow our officers on the street to immediately contact a clinician, whether it be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or 2 o'clock in the morning. they will have instant access to a trained clinician to be able to consult with that clinician in dealing with mental illness or in receiving some advice or some counseling on how to handle a particular situation.
In addition to that, we're able to now offer victim counseling for victims of crimes. We get referrals through our detective bureau. So if individuals have come in, they've been assaulted, they've been raped, then in need of support services, we'll deliver services to that individual. Another offshoot of the program is the death notification program. Since the program's inception, it's now become policy at the department that clinicians accompany police officers when they do a death notification. And in most cases, we stay with the individual after the officer has gone and help them get ready for services, help them notify other family members. Sometimes it's just a matter of making them a cup of tea. But we're able to provide services for people in the greatest time of need.
There are a lot of factors that come into play that ensure the success of the jail diversion program. But the most important factor, I think, is that it fulfills an important need. Police officers are always going to be charged with responding to mental illness calls in the community, and the jail diversion program provides them with a tool to better address a segment of the population that they're required to serve and to better respond to calls that are coming in on a daily basis. Through the jail diversion program, we now have access to a vast array of mental health resources that as police we never knew existed.
We've received a tremendous amount of positive feedback about the Framingham Jail Diversion Program. We've received a great number of cards and phone calls from individuals whose lives or family members' lives have been directly impacted by our services. It's most touching for me when individuals in the community recognize that this is a police-based program and they see that the police department has embraced this. It's easier for people to see that clinicians would want to help people in the community, but when they see that the police department really cares enough about its citizens to have this service available, that feedback is the most touching and most significant for me.
By me referring people off to the hospital to treatment through a clinician with a jail diversion partner in my car and at the scene, it creates a powerful message. We set a cultural tone for the department, and this is the way policing should be going. And anybody that wants to say that this is group hug, touchy-feely, we don't want to call criminal behavior, has this wrong. This is tough on crime, but it's compassionate criminal justice. This is what we're about.
That is our slogan, that is our theme, and that is really our driving philosophy. We want to deliver to the individuals that we serve in this community compassionate justice. So it may not be an arrest. It may end up as a result of the intervention in a more appropriate mental health referral.
The jail diversion program is probably one of the most outstanding examples of a win-win-win project that I've ever experienced in my career. It was great for the police because we gave them a new tool that allows them to be more effective with people who are emotionally disturbed and saves their resources for more police activities. It was great for our crisis clinicians because it enabled us to be right where people are hurting and to be there in a very safe way because we're in the company of the police. And most importantly, it enables people who are stress or psychiatric disturbance to actually get the help they need rather than find themselves tangled up in the criminal justice system.
After having them ride around with the police officers, it's amazing the difference it makes out here. It makes it a lot easier for us. It takes a lot of the stress out of our hands. A clinician is able to look at the situation, realize it might be a mental health problem, and get them the proper treatment rather than tie up the court system and rather than tie us up.
Because these clinicians are available, it allows the police officer to avoid unnecessary reports, unnecessary arrests, time wasted at calls. It allows you to get back on the street where you belong, answering emergency calls that require police expertise and not mental health expertise. The difference from when they were here, when they were not here before, and the time they're here now, it's night and day. They're just part of the program, the regular routine, and they do a fantastic job.
So here you have yet another example of what the community calls a win-win-win. a win for police officers, a win for the crisis counselors, a win for the person with mental illness. So I strongly, strongly hope and encourage our legislature to look at the funding. I think the funding needs to even be more. The funding also, to get technical, is for what's called infrastructure, which is about bricks and mortar typically. We also need funding for staffing. What we need to do really is to bring these programs to life and have them in our state. The police seem to really like it. They say they're not trained to do the assessment and they have a new tool. And it's more efficient to take somebody to a diversion crisis assessment place rather than hours in the emergency room waiting for someone to go into the state hospital. The system's very inefficient now. It's not healthy for people, and we need a lot of change. The idea of ride-alongs also having great value was another interesting point in this video, where clinicians ride with police, and the connection and cooperation between mental health and police is something that I hope would be a model and follow throughout the state. And I know we have some examples already, but I hear more about mental health in the jails than I do mental health working with police. Although I know in Davidson County, the sheriff's department does have some mental health people connected. But we can do better, and we should do better. And we can tell that by just looking at studies of the prevalence of people with mental illness in our jails. We also should not forget addiction, and people with addiction, as people with mental illness, can benefit from treatment. And rather than criminalizing and having a revolving door that eventually leads to prison, we get people into recovery with their families, back at work. And no, it won't work 100% of the time, and we're not planning to suspend laws for lawbreakers and get rid of punishment. So I think of this as a carrot and a stick approach. And you are listening to the NAMI Radio Show, by the way, and we're talking about criminal justice and reform. Now, the remainder of the time that's left, we are going to be hearing from Representative Cohen, Steve Cohen, from Tennessee, who's giving an address on mental health and corrections reform. Before we do that, just a couple reminders. Next Wednesday, we will have Katie Alexander, who is leading a coalition. The Great State Project is a coalition looking at basically Medicaid and access to Medicaid, but also the Affordable Care Act and future of Medicaid for Tennesseans. And there's over 30 organizations that are part of this coalition. NAMI Tennessee is one of them. This also is a very important issue of the day. Really, legislation is an important issue of the day. And I just want to mention another thing where you can come out and make a difference. First, I mentioned the Mental Health and Incarceration Conference. That's February 21st. And the easiest way, I think, to find that would be to go to the NAMI Tennessee Facebook page and look for it on there. There's links to our e-news in there. There's other flyers, or Google Mental Health and Incarceration Conference Nashville, or write me at info@namitn.org, and I'll get you the link. That's a program sponsored by Mental Health America of Middle Tennessee, and they should have the information as well. But we have that coming up. We also have Day on the Hill. Mental Health Day on the Hill is March 8th. And that's a day where mental health advocates and persons with mental illness and their caregivers will visit legislators to appeal for things like correction, dollars for correction reform, and other good policies so that we have appropriate access to treatment and good laws related to mental illness in Tennessee. Thank you for listening to the NAMI Radio Hour, and This is Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7 FM in Nashville, or streaming at radiofreenashville.org. And if you miss part of today's show or you'd like to hear the archives, go to NAMI Radio Hour /Podomatic or Google NAMI Radio Hour. You'll find a link to this and other shows, and help spread the word. Thanks for listening.
I've enjoyed every experience I've had in, as a legislator, and I'm proud of
it. It's Representative Steve Cohen from Memphis.
Signature bill, and it's one that took 20 years to pass. Tennessee's got the most difficult constitution in the country to amend, and we finally did amend it, got it to the voters, they approved it, and we've got this Tennessee Education Lottery, which is $3 billion, been very successful. It was a landmark issue in Tennessee because a lot of people didn't think it would ever happen. I was amazed when I drove through Tennessee. Basically, I kind of took the campaign on myself. It was me, my girlfriend, and our dog. And we drove around the state, and one time we got a plane and flew around the state, took my mother too, and made speeches and saw a lot of places in East Tennessee. You'd have thought I had horns. It was just amazing, you know, what they said about me and what they thought. It was going to be the end of the world, and the river was going to reverse course, and we'd have another real foot lake, and scurvy would be all over Tennessee. And none of those things happened, so it worked out okay. I was introduced one time by a friend named Polly Draper. Polly is an actress and a playwright. She was in 30-something. Some of y'all might have seen her. Her husband and I are friends, and she's a friend too. And she had been in the play The Exonerated, DNA Evidence, the Innocence Project, and she'd been in that play. And this is, I think, why she said this, but when she introduced me, Bernice, she said, I've known Congressman Cohen since we used to call him Senator Steve. And that was an appellation that my dear friend Warren Zevon attached to me. It was our nexus. We were friends with her. He was friends with her husband and me and put us together. And she said, he got that appellation because he was served in the Tennessee State Penitentiary for 24 years. And I think she had that from doing The Exonerated, where everybody was, after serving 18 years in the Texas State Penitentiary, DNA evidence. But anyway, it wasn't that bad. It was pretty good. Congress is okay. I appreciate your work. And so much of what you do moves justice forward. Most things that we have in justice, most issues that move things forward in our country have come through the courts. They have not come through the legislatures. Brown versus Board of Education, Loving versus Virginia, Gideon, Wainwright, I mean, all kind of cases over the years have come through. There's been judges who've made decisions after lawyers have made arguments. We had a bill up last week, which unfortunately, hate to tell you this, but the opinion of the ABA and the opinion of my side lost, but it was concerning some civil side issues, and to have the ABA's support is important. Sometimes people listen, but at least you know you've got the Betty Crocker Good Housekeeping seal of approval, and y'all move things forward. There are a lot of things changing, and while we get a lot of our input from groups like the ABA that do so much good, and I was so pleased by your statement about commutations, that's been very dear to my heart. Lawyers play such a keen role in that issue and others. I know that it will not come as a shock to any of you that our criminal justice system is broken, and it is broken, and that's what the president met yesterday with many police officials, law enforcement officials. I was invited and would like to have attended, but we had a long transportation markup of an infrastructure bill. We're going to have an infrastructure bill finally, and had some other issues to deal with, so I couldn't get off the Hill. But it was about our nation's prison population and how large it is. It's shocking that we have more prisoners than any country in the world. We are the gulag of nations. We're the greatest nation in the world, but somehow or another, we're the worst as far as incarcerating our own. 5% of the world's population is here in the United States, yet 20% of the prison population is here. And even the police, my police director, Tony Armstrong, and many policemen from all over, I think it was New York, Chicago, and most of the American League, got down to the AAA with Memphis. They were there yesterday and encouraging prison sentencing, criminal sentencing reform, and that the prisons are too crowded. They are. Mandatory minimums were a big mistake. They were popular. in the 90s. And over the past 30 years, our prison population has increased 500%. And there's an amazing and shocking racial disparity to that population. More than 60% are racial and ethnic minorities. And the impact that the criminal justice system has had on the African-American community has been extremely harmful, damaging. One in three African-American males can expect to go to prison at some time in their lifetime. One in three. For African-American males in their 30s, one of every 10 is in prison or jail on any given day. And that has ramifications that are harmful to the community when they're not male bothered figures around. The population, you talk about a war on women. There's six men for every 10 women in the African-American community. That's not good. I think the women, I should get an amen out of that, shouldn't I? Prison population is also aging. And the fastest growing population at federal correctional facilities now is prisoners over the age of 50. From 2009 to 2013, that population increased by 25%. The economic cost of keeping those people in prison is staggering. Health care costs skyrocketed 55% in the Bureau of Prisons in recent years. We spend roughly the same amount on health care for prisoners as we do on the entire agency that put many of them there, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Makes no sense whatsoever. In the commutation and pardon area, there are a lot of people in there that are old. The older you get, the less likely you are to have friends that can help you work in crime, and less likely you want to do crime. We should be letting those people out instead of keeping them in there, warehousing them, and spending a lot of money on health care costs in prison. But that's gone on. A lot of this has happened. A lot of the problems in the prison system is because of the failed war on drugs. The war on drugs was failed from its inception. In the 30s, Harry Anslinger, war on Hispanics, and that's why he called marijuana and not cannabis, because that was to tie it to the Latino population, and they made marijuana illegal, and it's gone on for years. Richard Nixon studied it, his administration studied it, I guess it was the governor, I think it was Schaefer from Pennsylvania, but it was they had a study, and they recommended decriminalization, or at the minimum, it might have been legalization, but I think it was decriminalization. But Nixon, with one of his two guys that were his awful henchmen, was either Haldeman or Ehrlichman, I think it was Haldeman, said it was just too good an issue to give up, and they wouldn't do it. And Nixon made some awful remarks about African Americans and drugs, and a way to keep them controlling them and using the war on drugs as in essence a way to work with Southerners.
Thanks for joining us today for the NAMI Radio Hour, exploring the world of mental illness and its impact on the family, society, and the individual. This broadcast comes your way live from the studios of WRFN Radio Free Nashville Pasquo each Wednesday at 10 a.m. Central Time. If you missed the show today or would like to hear the archives, link to podomatic.com and search for the NAMI Radio Hour. Again, that's podomatic.com and search for the NAMI Radio Hour. You can also keep up to date with the show's upcoming guests on the NAMI Tennessee Facebook page. The NAMI Radio Hour is a production of NAMI Tennessee. To contact the show, email to info@namitn.org or call 1-800-467-3589. That's 800-467-3589. We'll see you next week right here for another broadcast of the NAMI Radio Hour. Until then, remember, you are not alone. And don't get stuck in the trials of life. Keep moving on.